Case 14 is entitled Attendant Wool Passes Tea. Introduction, probing pole in hand, shadowing grass around him. Sometimes he wraps a ball of silk in iron. Sometimes he wraps a special stone with silk. To determine the soft by means of the hard is, of course, right. What about the matter of being weak and when meeting? What about the matter of being weak when meeting strength? Attendant case. Attendant Wo asked Deshan, "Where have all the sages since antiquity gone?" Deshan said, "Huh? What's that?" Wo said, "The order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise has shown up." Deshan let it rest. The next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Wo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wo on the head and said, Deshan patted Wo on the back. Wo said, "This old fellow has finally got a glimpse." Again, Deshan let the matter rest. Verse. Coming right up face to face, an adept knows. Here, sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent to fool the enemy army into not thinking ahead. Each shot a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind his head, the man is hard to run afoul of. Setting his eyes under his eyebrows, he got the advantage. So this is a koan. Attendant Wo asked Deshan, "Where have all the sages since antiquity gone?" And Deshan says, "Huh? What's that?" And Wo said, "The order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise showed up." The next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Wo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wo on the back. Wo said, "This old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse." Again, Deshan let the matter rest. So, many people think of Zen practice as contemplation, you know? People think of Zen practice as settling the mind, calming the mind, cultivating serenity. This is even called the Book of Serenity, and so on. If you say to somebody you're going on a retreat, they do have the idea of something very restful. And it's easy to form that opinion. You know, we spend all day sitting on our mats, and if somebody came in here by mistake and looked around, the room would be quiet, people would be motionless, and everybody would appear to be, you could say, this would be incorrect, but you could say, lost in her thoughts. Right. So you know when people are lost in their thoughts, that means they've tuned out the world, and they're utterly inward directed. Right. And it's possible to think about Zen this way as like a passive practice, or cultivation of calm and serenity. And this is actually a quite common understanding of meditation practice, even among people who practice meditation. So you will definitely, right now it's still the case that something like mindfulness is very popular. And usually mindfulness is associated with paying attention to the moment, focusing your mind, and usually it's also associated with qualities like calm and serenity and so on. There's definitely an element of this to Zen practice, and it's a very important element, you know. Life is really crazy, and if we're not very, very cautious, we get caught up in things to a degree that's really not good for our mental or physical health. You know, so it's possible that it's hard to believe that our society, that any society, has been more fast-paced and hectic than ours. I have a job where I go into work, and usually there's some problem that I didn't expect. And all day long, I'm interacting, and I have like a little, I'm old fashioned, so I still have a yellow pad on my desk. And if you can find it on my desk, because my desk is a cluttered mess. I was on the internet the other day, and I saw another article that said having a cluttered desk is a sign of superior intellect. And of course. You know, I knew it, you know, or, you know, creativity, greater creativity or something like that. So I knew it. I knew I didn't have to clean up my desk, you know. But I have a little pad next to my computer. And every day or periodically, I will make a list of all the things I have to do. And, you know, there was a time in my life when I used to have such a list, when I first didn't start doing my job, and I would go down the list and cross them off one by one. But then the list just got longer and longer, and, you know, I wouldn't even finish one list and I was already making another list. But I've actually had to go back to making lists again. But I never get through my list, you know. And it's definitely the case that some of my days are really hectic, you know. It'll be like 3:30 in the afternoon and I'll realize I haven't had lunch, you know. And you know, on some days I have to Zen until like 9:30, so it's a long day. Definitely very hectic. It seems like, my wife's life has been like that too forever and ever, you know. So, you know, we have on the second floor of our house, we have really one main bathroom with a shower. So we compete over the shower. And then we get everything and jump in our cars and drive off. And, you know, usually on the weekends, we'll, you know, how's it going? You know, how's it going? So it's wonderful, you know, at the end of a Wednesday, to come in and sit down in Lucy Stone Hall and just meditate. Right? It's a beautiful way to end the day and sort of decompress. And it just feels so magical to sit down and very tense muscles, and by the end of three sitting periods, you know, I'm supple and loose. And this is really valuable, right? I mean, I this alone is probably why most people come to the university and meditate. People tell me about their problems at work, and they have real problems, you know, and this is sort of like a lifeline to them. And especially when you just start meditating, finding this place is so magical, right? Finding this place is so magical. You realize that no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, you can get in touch with this kind of imperturbable calm. And indeed, when we meditate, it takes a few days for us to really get deeply into that calm. So for many people, it's around day three when they begin to settle into this deep, imperturbable calm. And for people like everybody here, it's probably happening today. It's happening a little faster, right? Where you're beginning to calm down and beginning to get into this deep, imperturbable calm. It's like the eye of a hurricane. You know, I can remember discovering that on the cushion when I had a lot of pain in my legs. You know, it just seemed like the pain was just knocking me back and forth. When I followed the breath out, you know, I just discovered during one rather terrible sit, you know, that there was this calm place, and I could just follow the breath to this calm place, and it wasn't like the pain completely went away, but it was definitely, I was like standing in a calm place looking at the pain instead of being swept in circles by the pain. And there were many sessions where I realized I could go to this place and it's been a wonderful thing. You know, 30 some years later, I'm still going to that place. And of course, if you're doing mu practice, you know, you definitely can get into this imperturbable place. You follow the breath out, and you call mu, and it's like, by around day two, by around today, many of the things that in your life that might have been bothering you are sort of receding in importance, right? And you suddenly realize, you know, this moment is all I have right now. It's the only thing that matters. And I'm just going to be present here with this emptiness. And that usually just does the trick, right? It's like suddenly you become serene and calm and empty. That's beautiful. So if you practice meditation, most people practice because of the calm it brings them. And that's deconditioning, right? I mean, when we are driven in our day-to-day lives by this crazy pressure, and it's a very powerful pressure because it's not just getting the job done, right? It's who you are, right? I mean, generally speaking, your job is who you are. So you know, if something's going wrong with your job, it's not just that you're having a hard time, it's that you're not being a good person or you're not being a successful person. So there's a really powerful motivation. We are so closely identified with our jobs, right, that when things are not going well, we feel not just like the challenge of a problem, but really there's a kind of personal threat to this, right? It's like, this is who I am. So much is riding on resolving all of these issues, and they tend not to get resolved. As soon as you solve one set of problems, another set of problems arises. So it's definitely liberating on day two of sesshin to be able to get to a place where you realize, okay, those problems are in my office right now, but right now I'm on the cushion and I'm going to just be present. What really matters now is just being present here. And this is hugely liberating. Most people aren't able to create such a space for themselves in out of the 24 hours of the day. Most people can't create such a space. And when they find that meditation can give them such a space, it's tremendously liberating. But, you know, if you just practice for serenity and you just practice for, like, release from that pressure, you definitely are shortchanging yourself. And you're definitely not realizing the real liberating power of meditation, of Zen, I would say, meditation. You know, one of the interesting things about working with the Mu Koan is that it really can take you to this place that's absolutely imperturbable. So you're calling Mu, you're calling Mu, you're calling Mu. But, you know, eventually something changes in the character of that emptiness. You know, we're expecting the emptiness to be calm and stable and placid, imperturbable. And it is superficially, right? If you stay with that emptiness long enough, you begin to realize that something is stirring in that emptiness. A kind of, you know, we Western people think of emptiness as empty. So there's something in the Western way of thinking, and there's emptiness, nothingness. But if you practice Zen for a long time, you begin to notice that when you're in that deep emptiness, there's a kind of pulsing energy that's coming out of that emptiness. And this is a something people don't necessarily notice right away, because they're trying to be calm, and they might think, well, I don't know why, but there's some kind of vibration. I keep trying to get it out of the way. But actually, that vibration is your Mu power knocking at your door. You know. Thoughts have this depleting quality. So when we're thinking, we're putting in tremendous energy into the process of thinking. And there's a very powerful defensive character to thinking. So, you know, as you're going through your day, you're sort of like protecting yourself with all the thinking that you're doing. And a lot of your thinking is emotionally reactive thinking. So a lot of thinking is really meant to protect us from things that are going on around us. A lot of some fantasy is involved in our mental lives, wish fulfillment, all this stuff, and also just it's kind of like we're sort of repressing a lot of the time. And all of this actually can have an enervating effect. It really drains our energy. If you're like me and you are a bit addicted to the internet, I read quite a few over my coffee in the morning, and sometimes at lunch I regret to say that I sometimes read the internet, and I read a lot of left-wing journals on the internet. So I read like Salon, Alternet, and I read a number of other left-wing journals. And you know, basically, I definitely have emotional responses to that, you know, that sort of like churn everything up. But I often think sometimes I'm doing this to distract myself from other anxieties I have, you know. So you know, at the end of browsing on the internet for a while, I can feel a little bit drained, you know, in some ways. But when I sit down on the cushion, it has a very different effect. You know, on a Wednesday night, if I do my zazen, you know, I feel totally energized. You know, calm for a little while, but then energized. If you practice meditation long enough, you realize that that emptiness is not just serene. That's a rather shallow experience of emptiness. When you stay with the emptiness for a long time, you realize it has this powerful energizing quality, restorative. You know, and when people come in from a busy day and they sit on a Wednesday night at the university, they feel so energized because they're turning off that the defense mechanism process. And they're like rerouting their energies. If you want to put it this way, it's like you're rerouting them into your physical life, you know, the life of your body. And it's like the body, it comes alive in a way that it normally doesn't when we're so absorbed in our thinking. You know, from the Buddhist standpoint, the body is like an energy system that is designed for waking up. And when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, if you're a beginner, you begin to feel that stirring in your in the emptiness, and sometimes it may even feel like a stirring in your hara, in your dantian, the region below your navel. If you breathe from the dantian, you know, when you start going into emptiness, you may begin to feel the dantian becoming activated. So this is not a distraction, this is what's supposed to happen. As you stop thinking, and so much of our thinking is like defensive, and we begin to just relax into the emptiness, the body, it's like the body, it comes back to life, your natural body, and your hara or your dantian is activated. And you begin to feel like a tightness around your belly button as you breathe. And this is not a symptom of tension. This is a symptom of the, it's like your body is encased in ice, and as you chip away the ice, it's finally out of the ice, and then there's like a little light around your belly button, and it comes on, and it starts pulsing, right? And this is like your body restored to kind of balance or mental health. And so, you know, when people are doing the Mu Koan, at first it feels like a dead void. It can feel that way for a long time. It can feel calm and reassuring. Then it can feel like a dead void, or it can feel like a dead void. But eventually, when you go into deep Mu Shin, you begin to realize there's this pulsing energy in Mu, in emptiness. This is why people are asked to call Mu in the kitchen. I want to feel, I want to see and hear how much of this energy you're able to tap into. And it seems like a crazy exercise, but it's not. A teacher can really tell to some degree how much you're able to access that energy. But some people are, you know, profoundly wedded to like the idea of meditation as serenity or calm. For me, you know, getting into deep emptiness was very liberating because it did provide me with a kind of stability and calm that was really beneficial at a chaotic time in my life, emotionally and personally. And so it was hard for me to notice the active dimension of mu. And it took me almost 5 years to answer the mu koan. And I would go into emptiness and go into this deep, deep serenity. And I would come into the Dokusan room and Genki Roshi would say, well, please call mu, call mu. Everybody else would go in and go, mu, mu. And I would go in there and I could not do it. It was like, I don't know why, but I can't do this. I remember I went to one sesshin, and, you know, I was sitting deeper, 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 and I went into the Dokusan room at the end of the sesshin, and Genki said, you know, it was like he was saying, come on, just give it a try, you know. I just couldn't. I shook my head. I just can't do it, you know. I see now that I just didn't want to open up to that energy because I didn't have the trust in the process. And I didn't trust the process enough, you know. And some people might laugh at calling mu in the kitchen, but, you know, that's a kind of sin, actually, kind of slightly cynical. It's like it's a defense mechanism too, right? People don't want to open up to that energy. It's uncontrollable. And you have to just be totally open and trust the process. But, you know, once you begin to access that energy dimension of mu, you know, Zen is a different practice. You know, this is not about dwelling in calm and serenity, although dwelling in calm and serenity is an important part of Zen practice. It's imperative, really, to get into deep samadhi, that motionless state, right, that we all enter if we've been practicing meditation for a couple of years. You know, you begin to sit down on the cushion and you just go right there. It's like nothing is stirring, right? And then, you know, if you keep going, though, you begin to get this energy. And this transforms our practice. You know, Zen is not about tranquilizing the mind. It's not about being calm. It's about totally liberating ourselves from our cultural instructions and living a different life, in a life that comes out of that energy, actually. It's like, you know, the Dalai Lama once said that Buddhism is about, you know, the complete transformation of the human being. And people must read that and think, well, what's that all about? But, you know, Zen wants to start with something very elemental. You know, the relationship between us and our bodies. How we, you could say, how we circulate the energy in the energy system that we call the body-mind. And that the way we circulate our energy is dictated by our culture. So, you know, when I was in Seattle, a couple times I had a chance to work as a substitute teacher in an elementary school. And one of the biggest jobs of an elementary school teacher is to make sure everybody sits down and stops moving. So you're teaching them how to direct their bodily energy, right? And you're actually kind of like tamping down that energy. You're teaching them how to be immobilized, right? And there are even teachers who will say, oh, I see some fingers moving. Everybody's supposed to be you're at your desk totally motionless, right? And it's sort of lifeless. And as a college teacher, you know, I'll come into a class people are like that. You know, the lessons have been learned, right? They're like comatose, right? It's just like they're sort of comatose looking, waiting for the hour to be over, And that is something they learned. So we learn how to circulate this energy in our body, and we learn to sort of like be dead somewhat, right? You could be lively in these ways, but not in these ways, right? And so, you know, basically, a lot of people do feel a loss of, affect or loss of joy in life. And it's not just about their philosophy, it's about how they are structuring their own relationship to their bodies. So Zen is like therapeutic in a very profound way. We go back to zero and we start rebuilding the human being in a different way. You know, it's like we're activating this body's energy and we're going to put it into a new, you could say, like a system. And so, you know, a lot of Zen is back and forth between like deconditioning and rebuilding, deconditioning and rebuilding, deconditioning and rebuilding. And each time we're working with a koan, we're like deconditioning and then discovering another way to exist, you know, another aspect to how we can exist in a different way. And, you know, it's like little by little you're putting yourself back together in a very different, very profoundly different way. So the koan, this might seem to have nothing to do with the koan, but Attendant Wo asked Daishan, "Where have all the sages since antiquity gone?" You know, he's really saying, in one way, he's saying something that's a very Chinese convention, which is that the ancients were wise and we're foolish. You know, so where have all the wise ones of the past gone? Daishan says, like, what was that? No. You could say, Attendant Wo is living in the past. You know, part of Zen practice is, it involves deconditioning or letting go who we were. Letting go who we were. You know, in fact, you know, in a way, this is the biggest part, the biggest problem in Zen practice is that it's hard to let go of who we were. You know, because even if we're unhappy, we sort of cling to the self we're familiar with. And even if it's sort of a devitalized, not very energetic self, we still prefer it. And so, you know, maybe one way to think about this koan is that Wo is sort of like a part of ourselves, you know. We're holding on to the past, you could say. And Daishan, when he says, "Oh, where are those, you know," it's like, I know people who really do think that their elementary school years were the best years of their lives. You'll meet such people. You know, you'll meet people who say, "Oh man, you know, I remember playing ball on a Saturday afternoon." This is really my generation because I don't know that so many kids play baseball anymore. But you'll talk to people my age and they'll say, "Oh man, those were the best days of my life. You know, it was a Saturday afternoon. We were playing ball, you know, until dark. My mother would call me and I'd say, 5 more minutes, Mom, 5 more minutes, right?" And, you know, those were the best days of my life. Now, you know, we all have a tendency to do that, right? And it's healthy to value those moments in our life. But on the other hand, it's very important, to realize that, you know, part of the process of self-transformation is letting go of the past and allowing yourself to explore new possibilities, right? You know, a lot of Zen practice is letting go of the past and allowing yourself to explore new possibilities. And I think in all Zen practice, there's a little bit of tension between these two things, right? You know, there are things about the past that we love, and we don't have to totally throw them in the trash, but and sometimes the past contains lessons for the future. That's certainly true. But, you know, I think the Zen life is about trusting this process of going forward, going forward, going forward, and constantly being willing to remake yourself, yeah? You know, somebody I admire a great deal, I guess if you follow, if you follow my Facebook page, and I hope you don't, but is Bernie Sanders. I love Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I have my Bernie Sanders campaign lawn signs in my garage, you know. He, you know, Bernie Sanders is 77 years old and he's running for president, you know. And Bernie Sanders has gone through, if you're a fan of Bernie Sanders the way I am, he's gone through so many different, you could say, incarnations. You know, Bernie Sanders was like a college radical. For a while, he lived in kind of like a hippie. He lived a hippie life. He became mayor of Burlington, Vermont, which in those days was like a counterculture town. Apparently, he used to come to his office in work boots and blue jeans, right? So he was sort of a hippie. But, you know, he's totally transformed himself again and again, and he seems to have this boundless energy. And I don't think he does Zazen. I doubt it. But he definitely has something going on, right, where he doesn't cling to the past, right? He doesn't cling. I think that's part of where his energy comes from, is that he understands that, you know, basically there's a way to live where you're constantly transforming yourself in response to things around you. And instead of looking backwards at the losses, and we all have losses, right? We all have these losses. You know, if you look at life backwards, it's a series of losses. If you're young, this is not obvious yet, right? But eventually, if you get old enough and you look backwards at your life, it's just like a series of losses. It's like gone, 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 gone. And I'm at a place in my life now where, you know, it's literally possible for me to look at an old address book, and a lot of the people are no longer here. You know, if you look at life that way, it's like endless losses. But, you know, there's another way to live, which is this trust in the process. You know, Zen is teaching you to live, you could say, forward into like an unknowable future. And that's really like where the energy comes from, I would say. The energy comes from that. You know, so you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we're working with our koan, we have an idea of what the answer should be based upon our past experience. But, you know, actually the koan maybe wants us to see things in a new way. And so, you know, there's usually a bit of a conflict in working with a koan between past experience and the future. You know, the possibilities that are emerging right here and now. And that's what attendant woe is not seeing. You know, attendant woe says to Deshan, where have all the sages of antiquity gone? And Deschamps, you know, just says, oh, come off it, basically. He's in an oblique way, he says, I'm not even going to dignify that with a response. I'm certainly not going to agree. And Woe interprets his unwillingness to play the game as, a defect. He says, you know, I was calling for a flying dragon and I'm getting a lame tortoise. Deschamps let it rest. The next day, when Deschamps came out of the bath, Woe passed him some tea. It's like, Woe has been thinking it over, and now he now has a different view of what happened. But he's still living in the past, right? I mean, it's important to think over our lives and change our opinion. But it's really what's coming next that is the important thing. It's how can we respond creatively and open-heartedly to the thing that's on the way now, see? And so Deschamps pats him on the back, you know, good man. And Woe said, you know, I think I'm getting a glimpse. I think I'm starting to understand. And Deschamps, again, just doesn't say anything, you know. Coming right up, face to face, an adept knows. It's like face forward. Here, sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent to fool the enemy army into not thinking ahead. Each shot a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind his head, the man is hard to run afoul of. Setting his eyes under his eyebrows, he got the advantage. So, you know, this is a koan about the dynamic aspect of Zen practice. There's always a little, you know, actually, every time you work with a koan, it involves something that does feel a little bit like a loss. Really, it does. There's an element of loss in working with a koan because you're giving up what you were or what you had, and you're asked to give it up in exchange for something you don't even know yet. That's a big element in Zen training. But, you know, if you give it up, you know, that's the past is already gone, you know. And the future is on the way. So the question is, now what will you be? Now what will you do? And as usual, please trust the process. Shujo.